Welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is honored to have with us author C.R. Coombs, the author of the Sheriff Ulysses Walker series. Before we begin, the Poison Pen does have copies of both books in the series, Murder at Sleeping Tiger and A Thirst for Murder, available for purchase. If you'd like a copy of one or both, please just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen Bookstore. We would be happy to connect you with these truly entertaining mysteries. Now I'd like to welcome author C.R. Coombs.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm delighted to talk about both my books.
Well,
it's been really
well,
fun.
We're certainly interested to hear what you have to say. I always like to begin with authors because as a reader, I'm fascinated by essentially their backstory. So before you became a published author, who was Cedar?
Well, for 30 years, I was a psychotherapist and consultant, and also did trainings and presentations on a particular kind of psychotherapy called dialectical behavior therapy, which is an evidence-based treatment for borderline personality disorder.
Wow, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
When did you decide that you wanted to start writing? Because you've written novels, but you've also written nonfiction and poetry.
That's right. I actually wrote poetry from an early age, and prior to being a psychotherapist, I was poet in residence at Duke University Medical Center.
Wow.
And I worked in their cultural arts department. And then I wrote a number of research articles that were published in peer-reviewed journals and magazines, and I also wrote poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And after, as I got closer to retirement, I decided to write a book about the mindfulness component of the therapy I did. And that book is called The Mindfulness Solution for Intense Emotions. And it's been sort of a semi-bestseller.
Nice.
And it continues to sell. It was published in 2016. But I got interested in mysteries because my first mystery, as you know, Murder at Sleeping Tiger, is set during a Zen retreat called a sesshin. And I used to assist Dr. Marcia Linehan, who became a Zen Roshi. She's the developer of the treatment that I used to do. I used to assist her at retreats. And retreats are always held in very remote and kind of beautiful places. And one night I was thinking, gosh, this would be a really interesting setting for a murder. Not your typical thought that you have, but it kind of kept arising. And about 4 years later, I retired and I sat down and I wrote Murder at Sleeping Tiger from start to finish. And so I enjoyed that so much, I decided to write a second one.
You introduce readers to Sheriff Ulysses Walker in Murder at Sleeping Tiger. What prompted you to want to use him as your detective instead of an amateur sleuth?
Well, I was interested in, I wanted to have a kind of a real lawman. Sheriff Walker is young. He's Anglo. He grew up on a commune in the Taos area. But he's a family man. He has two children. He has a very loving wife who figures in the story. And his character just sort of emerged and took hold of me. I thought he was just I like good guys.
Yeah.
I have a lot of bad guys
Yeah.
in my books, but I like to have a good guy. And he's not perfect, but he's a straight shooter. And also, I'm also interested in the fact that sheriffs have so much power.
Oh.
And they are not really supervised by anyone. So they can really go awry. They can do terrible things. And they're presented with opportunities to do things not the right way. So I liked that as well.
How did you, I'm sure there was some research involved in getting the details right about the procedures of solving a crime from the sheriff's perspective. Did you talk to local law enforcement people? What kinds of research did you do to kind of create his character and make it more real?
I did have to do a good bit of research. I didn't actually talk to law enforcement, but I read some manuals and some procedural books. And I'm a lifelong lover of mystery stories. And also there's fabulous, fabulous stuff on television. And so, I'm like a sponge. I soak it up. I did want to keep this one. These are not procedurals by any means. These are I mean, these are almost like Westerns. They have they have that adventure element in them, both books, where there's there's a chase. And that was more based on, I love the outdoors. I spent a lot of time in the outdoors, and I've spent time in all of the areas that I write about. But I didn't talk to law enforcement. That's an interesting idea. Probably would be a good thing to do.
There's always future books. One of the things that you capture in the series is how in New Mexico, as well as in some other parts of the West, policing is not just a one government entity. There's the local, like the sheriff or the local city police. There's also the tribal police or the tribal law enforcement aspect of it. And I'm sure that's something that people outside would not really think about, but it really does have an impact in New Mexico.
Yes, that's absolutely true. That was something I had to do a lot of research on, and I apologize for my dogs
Oh,
barking.
that's all right.
You have the FBI, which handles all of the federal things that happen on federal lands, and the reservations, or the pueblos in this case, are federally administered. They're sovereign nations, but they're federally overseen. And then you have, the city police, the local police. Ulysses Walker himself was a detective, homicide detective in Santa Fe before he moved back to Taos and ran for sheriff. So I did have to do a lot. That's tricky.
Yeah, it comes. Well, you really show how it's a cooperative venture in many cases between the different groups.
Yes, and I got very interested in having Lisbeth Talishay. She's a character who's in all three, going to be in all she's going to be in the third book as well. She's in both these books. And then, of course, Ray Pondo, one of my favorite characters, who's the war chief in book one, and in book two, he's a tribal council member from the Picaris tribe. So, and I had to do a lot of research on the Picaris tribe, which is my neighbor tribe, and I go to their ceremonial dances. And so I've received some support from the tribe to get it right.
That's interesting. One of the other things I loved about the first book is, I'll be honest, I knew nothing about, or very next to nothing about Buddhism and Zen and the whole retreat process. And it's fascinating to see how that works for someone who might not be familiar with it. Can you tell us a little bit of, because I didn't know that you had to like go on these mandated silent time periods, and that was a that there's a whole structure to, like, there's one person in charge of the whole, I want to say, retreat or whatever you call it, but there's other people that are involved.
Yes, that was again, they say write what you know. And as I said, I've assisted at a number of these retreats. And there's at a formal retreat, there's a Roshi who is the Roshi means old teacher, the person who's in charge. And then he or she has people who are part of her sangha, her group, who do various duties. Like you have one person who rings this bell, and one person who rings that bell, and one person who takes people to interviews, and all of these various things. And they're very, Murder at Sleeping Tiger is based on a rohatsu, which is a very formal and long sesshin. And a lot of people like to do rohatsu, not because they're compelled to do it. Really, nobody is compelled to do it unless you take monastic vows, then it's part of that. But people enjoy the silence and nothing to do mind, as it's called. And so, you know, they come together for a period of time and there's a real communal feeling, even though you aren't talking to each other or even making eye contact. So again, I thought it was a perfect setup for a murder. Well, and I think that's to some extent, it's not because, you know, Buddhists are more murderous than they're actually probably a great deal less so, but because the atmosphere itself would be perfect for, you know, a kind of a stealthy situation. And of course, then you have a snowstorm on top of that. So
a very classic kind of mystery thing where they're close from society.
Yes, a lockbox type of, not exactly, but close, you know, sort of, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's see. One question I just had as a reader is these different Buddhist groups or things like that, some of them can be quite large, I guess. Like I got the impression from the book, like cities like Los Angeles. I'm almost thinking in a way they're kind of a counterpart to mega churches or something like that, or maybe not on that level.
Not quite. I don't think they're that big.
Okay.
I mean, you know, there may be, for example, you know, like San Francisco, for example, may have a sangha of 150 people.
Oh, okay.
But like in Santa Fe, in that area, it's more likely to be about 30.
And this is just ignorance on my part, but there actually are Buddhist kind of retreats and centers in New Mexico.
Yes, there's a very famous one called Upaya.
Oh, okay.
That is quite lovely. And yeah, you can go to a retreat there and it would be a very positive experience.
That's so. What I love as a reader about mysteries. You are always learning something new, especially when the author is sharing their knowledge with you. Let's move to your new book, which is A Thirst for Murder. That's the second in the series. And one of the things that you address that I'm a little bit familiar with, because Arizona is close to New Mexico, but people outside the West may not realize this, is how important water is to those people living in the West.
Absolutely. There's, you know, I have a little foreword where I talk about the importance of water and how there's that old saying, whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting. And, you know, you think of a movie like the Milagro Beanfield War that came out, oh gosh, about 25 years ago or more, where people in a small northern New Mexico community are struggling to keep their gardens alive. Well, I served as an acequia commissioner for 8 years. And so I was intimately involved in making sure that the guy here is working the pool and the dogs are like ready, you know. But so I know a lot about this. And there's the micro, which is the acequias. Mm-hmm. And then there's the macro, which is municipalities and industries and developments fighting over large amounts of water. Mm-hmm. And every single drop is accounted for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, New Mexico has compacts where they have to send water onto Texas down in the South. So it's a perfect situation for some murders. and also for there to be a lot of, you know, unknowns about who might be behind it.
And for those, again, that aren't familiar with the West, in New Mexico, mainly the water is coming from the mountain region and things like that. The snowfall, the rain gathers there, and then it comes down into the lower parts of the state, or?
That's correct. The main two rivers in the state are the Rio Grande and the Pecos. And those two rivers are, they come from out of state and bring water into the state. But the vast majority of the water comes from snow that melts and flows into streams that then are tapped by local people since the early 1800s have dug this elaborate system of ditch irrigation.
That's what I thought was especially fascinating, because you have that set up there, and the Phoenix metro area also has the Hohokam, who centuries ago had kind of developed their own irrigation canals that a lot of what we are using today is kind of built on that or based on that. So,
right. And they had some fairly thriving results. Hohokam, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
So, yeah.
And then you have, especially, I would guess, in the last 30 years, if not more, this whole rush of people moving into the West, the buildup of residential areas, the battle for water rights. And I guess people don't realize that you can sell the rights.
That's right. It's not easy, but it has always been done. I mean, there used to be this group during the period of time when New Mexico was a territory. It only became a state in 1912.
Yeah.
But when it was a territory, there was this group called the Santa Fe Ring. And what they did is they went into northern New Mexico and they bought land that had been part of the commons. And they bought it, privatized it, took the water rights from it, and sold it separately. They were criminals. And they reigned until around 1920. They were really quite destructive. And one of the most destructive things that they did was they sold off these water rights. And they impoverished some of the people who they bought from, and made themselves very rich. Mm-hmm. And so A Thirst for Murder is kind of a modern story that's sort of similar to that old story, the bad old days of the Santa Fe Ring.
Yeah, you see one of the characters in A Thirst for Murder, your Native American tribal war chief council member, is kind of getting pressured to put his vote in to let the tribe release some of their water rights.
That's right. You know, what has happened in New Mexico, there's always, this is fiction, but in this book, that's actually a Taos Pueblo member, not a Picaris Pueblo member. And Taos Pueblo has that huge mountain behind it that gets covered with snow, and they have a lot of water. And there have been some big court decisions stipulating that the Native American tribes have priority access to the water because they've been there the longest. And so, of course, when they have access to that water and they have a lot of it, then people come calling, wanting some of that water. And that is one of the plot lines in A Thirst for Murder.
Let's talk a little bit about the books, your book setting for the series, because New Mexico, for those that might not have visited or be familiar with it, is actually a very diverse state. And you bring that across in your stories. Can you tell us a little bit about the different faces of New Mexico?
Yes, I'd be happy to. You know, New Mexico has the largest Native population of any state other than Alaska. And so the major tribes there are the eight northern Pueblos, which of which Picaris and Taos are two, And they have three different language groups, but they all have a similar religion. And then you have the Jicarilla Apache, who lived in the Sangre de Cristos and also in some of the mountains down south. And then you have the Comanche, who ruled the area in the 18th century, completely ruled it. And then there are some other small tribes the Navajo, oh gosh, the largest tribe in the United States, but they're, and of course, Tony Hillerman wrote about them so eloquently, and they're in the Northwest. And then the Spanish came in the 16th century, and they came as both a military force and also as a religious conversion force. And they came in, they conquered the Puebloan people, and they suppressed and kept down the, they were actually themselves kind of ruled by the Comanche until the repeating rifle. That's when things changed, but changed permanently. But they also brought in Catholicism. However, the Puebloan people are on their ancestral lands. They speak their ancestral languages. They keep their religion. And they also practice Catholicism. So, you know, go figure. And then there are also a number of what we call crypto Jews, which are Spanish people, people of Spanish origin who were persecuted during the Inquisition, went underground, came to Mexico, and then migrated north to New Mexico. And then all the other people who they call Anglo, which include, you know, African Americans and, you know, all kinds of white people. Mm-hmm. So it's a varied group, and Los Alamos National Lab is there, and that has brought in, you know, many, many different kinds of people. It's a very artistic state with lots of artists and galleries and native artists and Spanish artists. So it's a very interesting place to visit and to live and to read about.
Let's talk a little bit about your process for writing your novels, because writers approach mysteries in different ways. Some like to kind of plot things out, because theoretically in a mystery, you need to plant clues, you need to have suspects, you need to ultimately solve the murder. But other writers tend to use their version of winging it. How do you approach writing mysteries? Is it more of a structured thing, or do you just kind of hope that it comes together in the end?
Well, it's a little bit of both. You know, I never want to block my, I don't want to trim my wings.
Okay.
Because that's where the inspiration comes. And that's where, like, just yesterday, I was working on book three, and a character showed up fully formed. I'm not kidding, John. You know, I could see her.
Mm-hmm.
I could hear her voice. I knew what she was going to say. I knew her demeanor. Mm-hmm. But it happened like that. I was writing, and there she was.
Yeah.
And I don't ever want to lose that, because that's so much of the fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have to, I write a synopsis. Once I get the feeling of where the trajectory of the story is, I will write out a synopsis. And then I give myself 100% permission to vary from that.
Mm-hmm.
But it means a lot of rewriting. But I don't care, because I love to rewrite.
Yeah.
I mean, I love to compose, and I love to edit. And sometimes editing is even more creative than composing. So, and I write from start to finish. In other words, I don't write segments and then try to link them together. I write from the beginning to the end. And I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's what works for me. And it allows me to, I have plenty of time to make the changes that I need to make if I decide I don't want to go down a road that's in my synopsis.
You were a poet before you were a novelist and a writer.
Yeah.
Does that aspect of writing poetry, influence your novel writing? Because you have, there's, at least from my perspective as a reader, I see a very calculated effort to be precise in your word choice. There's, you're almost like you're choosing what you're saying, because I don't write poetry, but my guess is you have to be very, very judicious with how you say things.
Well, thank you. I am still a poet. As a matter of fact, while this book was, book two was in press, I wrote a chapbook of poems. And about the Shakers. I don't know if you're familiar with the Shakers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up in Kentucky near a Shaker town.
Oh.
So I think the way that the poetry influences my fiction is that I try to bring in the natural world as much as I can. So I'm very, very aware of the season. I'm aware of the plants and animals and birds that are around. I'm aware of the beauty of the sky and the mountains, the, you know, all of the things that as a poet, I allow myself to indulge in professionally. You know, I'm a birder. Mm-hmm. And a gardener. And so I bring in all of those elements and I try to be as correct and precise as I can. So, you know, I'm not going to have like a great bird of paradise flying through New Mexico. You know, it's going to be a specific, it's not just going to be a generic bird.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to take advantage of moments where something is observed. There's a part in Murder at Sleeping Tiger where Ulysses is chasing a suspect and it's just before dawn and suddenly the coyotes erupt in a, you know, in their very strange howling. And that is not lost on him, you know. So I try to find those moments. And I want my books to be not only page turners and entertaining, but also to be in a funny way uplifting. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot, they're not dark books.
No.
They're dark things happen.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not like dystopic.
Yeah, they're not graphic or anything like that.
Right. Yeah. They're not cozy either.
No, they're very realistic, especially the first book in real world events and how it impacts society and people in that. But yeah, you don't, they're not, you don't dwell in unnecessary details or things like that.
Yeah.
You have been writing for a while now. I know there are a lot of aspiring writers out there who want some guidance, some advice. If you were working with someone who was just starting out, what's the best advice you would give them as a writer?
Oh, boy. I guess it would be, if you really want it, it will happen. If you really, really want this, it will happen. I mean, because I wanted to write full time from the time I was about 12 years old. And life just didn't work out that way. I mean, don't get me wrong. I had a great career. I had a fun time. I raised a family and, you know, I've had a great life, but I always wanted this. I never gave up on wanting it. And time was provided for me. An opportunity happened. And I think part of the reason why I chose genre fiction, you know, mystery stories for my fiction, is because I had the sense that I could do it. It was doable. Mm-hmm. And when the time presented itself, I just sat down. I mean, when a thought came, this would be a good retreat. This would be an interesting way to set a murder mystery. Mm-hmm. I just did it. So I guess I would say to writers, keep believing in yourself. Keep believing in your dream. And when the time is right, you might be really surprised that it will just come. I hope that's not too simplistic, but
yeah,
it was for me.
In some ways, it's very profound. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Cedar as a reader, because mm-hmm. I'm always fascinated. Are there particular books throughout your life that kind of have been touchstones for you as an author? Did you always read mysteries? What are some of the books that you would say, these were important to me, these are important to me?
Well, that's a great question. I'm a avid reader. I'm always reading two or three books and listening to a book on tape. And I read widely. I read, you know, bestsellers, potboilers, and I read, you know, William Faulkner, and I'm just reading a Kay Gibbons book. And I just finished The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, fabulous book that came out a few years ago. And I read history. I read a lot of history. I'm reading a book, and I'm not going to be able to give the name of the author, but it's called The Shattering of the Union, the United States in the 1850s.
Yeah.
And so I love history, and history is a very, it's both consoling, because as bad as things are, they've been worse, you know?
That's true.
And also just the details of the way people behave. Mm-hmm. So books that have meant a lot to me. Yes, I have read mysteries. I read all of Nancy Drew when I was about 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And you know, and when I was 10, I read all of James Bond, oh. You know, so I've read all kinds of popular literature, but I have to say that my, the books that I would cite as being most important to me, other than mysteries, and I'll save one mystery series that probably won't surprise anyone for last, but our Southern literature. I'm a Southerner. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've read all of, you know, Eudora Welty, and I've read all of William Faulkner, and I'm rereading William Faulkner and mm-hmm. Mark Twain and Wendell Berry. I've read all of his novels. And so those are the ones, and I think that's where my character voice is. If you start listening to Rosemary Walker or Lisbeth Talishay, you're going to hear some Wendell Berry in there probably.
Yeah.
And my favorite, no surprise, mystery series is Tony Hillerman. Yeah. I think he is truly a treasure. And, but I also love P.D. James, and yeah. Atkinson is another favorite. So I just love to read, and I it's a relief when I come to the time of my day when I can sit down, pick up a book. It's almost like meditating for me.
That's so great. Yeah. Which brings me to my own question for you, because you are something of an expert in this. Can you talk a little bit or say something about, I was just so impressed in reading your books about the importance of, I think you call it mindfulness, but just of finding, especially it seems like in recent times, points in your life where you can just get away from the noise and kind of center yourself.
Absolutely. I feel the need for it every day. And, you know, I not only practice everyday mindfulness, which is sort of like, you know, if I'm eating alone, I don't want to be reading or listening even to the radio. I just want to be appreciating the moment, chewing my food, not because it's some kind of virtue, but because it brings me into the present moment. And I also practice seated mindfulness of, you know, meditation. And what it does is it creates this little space between my to-do list, my impending day, and my present moment awareness of that I am alive. And, you know, I credit my meditation teacher with this, you know, just like basically inculcating this into me, like, don't miss out on your life. Don't miss out on the joy of your breath. And it really works with emotions. I wrote a whole book about it. I mean, you know, if you have strong emotions, and I do, you know, you want to be sure you're not acting on them, that you're actually stepping back. You know, unless it's like to come up to your partner and hug them and say you love them, you know, that's good to act on. Maybe not if they're, you know, in the middle of a business meeting, but you know. So yeah, it is a very important, and you know, my character, Ulysses Walker, is a daily meditator, well, when he can. And so, you know, I think that's part of what makes him a good guy. Is that he's a thoughtful person. He's a mindful person.
You've kind of hinted, and you can say as much as you want, but we can expect another book in the series.
Yes, that's right. I'm working on book three right now.
Any
And it's
clues as
coming
to
along.
that's great. How can readers learn more about you? Do you have a website? I
I
think.
do cedarcoons.com, and I have a blog, and so that's a good way to learn more about me. And I think too that you know, my poetry is very, the poetry book is out. It's called Bourbon and Branch, Good Kentucky Girl, and it's very personal. The poems are very personal. My second book, The Shaker Book, it's called Come Life, Shaker Life. It's not out yet. That one is not as personal, but the first book is very personal.
That's wonderful. I can't believe how quickly our time has just flown by. We've been very fortunate at the Poison Pen to have author Cedar Koons, who's writing a series of mysteries as C.R. Koons featuring Sheriff Ulysses Walker. I'd like to thank Cedar for taking time to share her thoughts with us today, and thank those of you tuning in virtually to another author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.